Welcome to season 6 of Radio Cachimbona. Radio Cachimbona is an abolitionist podcast that audio archives state repression and fierce migrant resistance in the southern Arizona borderlands and breaks down case law and politics from a leftist perspective. As the daughter of Salvadoran immigrants, Yvette prioritizes uplifting the voices and histories of Central Americans. This week, I'm excited to share yet another Unlocked Lit review with myself and guest Ronnie Wallenzer, where we discuss La Calle, spatial conflicts and urban renewal in a Southwest city by Lidia Otero. We discuss how urban renewal is really just a euphemism for gentrification, break down how Tucson elites attempted to whiten the city's history, and emphasize the deep history of racial segregation of the city of Tucson. I hope that you all are enjoying me unlocking the lit reviews. It is something that I'm opening up to the wider public audience because I know discussions that we have on the lit review are also necessary and critical for y'all. So I am going to be sharing more of the lit reviews. Thanks so much to Grant Bloom for the new introduction song. I really, really love it and think it really elevated the podcast. So thank you so much for helping me out with that. And thank you to the Fuerte Arts Movement for the audio editing as always. I'm eternally grateful to everybody who supports. Thank you to Chelly, who is the newest patron. Welcome. And I hope that you all enjoy this episode. Thanks so much for being here, Cachimbonas. Love y'all. Hello, Cachimbonas. I am so excited to have my dear friend and comrade, Ronnie, here today, back on the podcast to discuss the book La Calle, Spatial Conflicts and Urban Renewal in a Southwest City by Lidia Otero.
Yay! Hi, Cachimbonas.
But before we get into it, Ronnie, I just wanted to ask, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here with you, Yvette. Thanks for having me back on the pod. I'm really excited to talk about not one of my favorite things, but my favorite things to talk about, urban renewal. We're going to get into it, but we can chalk it up to gentrification.
Yes, yes. Perfect. So we wanted to start with the quote that the intro starts out with. It's a conversation that happens between two Tucsonenses, which we'll get into the meaning of that word later on. But it starts with Alba Torres approaching Rodolfo Soto, and they're having a conversation about the changes in Tucson. Ay, Albita, ¿cómo estoy triste de lo que están haciendo aquí?
¿Por qué, señor?
Porque se les va a olvidar dónde empezó el pueblo. Están tumbando todo y no se van a acordar de nosotros. Y a nadie le va a importar, y no se van a acordar de nosotros, y a nadie le va a importar. Ronnie, can you share why you wanted us to start with that quote?
I think it's really important. Alba Torres is kind of challenging the cultural elitism and politics that drove the destruction of La Calle. They're talking about how nobody's going to remember the people that built this, and also no one's going to care. And so I'm super grateful for Lidia Otero's research to develop this book, to write this book, to gather these histories. Also, really importantly, to center the people who lived and were displaced from the surrounding area known as the 80 acres that were known as La Calle.
Something that's good that I like to do at the beginning of lit reviews is just give a little summary for folks, because I encourage everyone to read the lit review picks. They're things that I pick out of love, things that I think every organizer should be reading. But at the same time, I know that we live really busy lives and that you might not have time to read the book. So if you don't, then I just give a little summary at the top so you can follow the convo, because I feel like there's great stuff to learn from the conversation about the book, even if you're not going to read the book.
Especially if you live in Tucson.
Defo.
Know the history of your city.
I know,
city.
And I hope most of my listeners are in Tucson. I think that the biggest geographic concentration is actually in Los Angeles, though.
Wow, interesting.
Which is interesting, yeah. But someone told me that it's, like, not that weird because they said if you put out any Latinx content, like, you're going to have a significant percentage of your stuff. Yeah, of, like, people in L.A. because L.A. is cool.
That's where we got it. Shout out L.A. What's up, East L.A.? Blue Heights.
Okay, so the book discusses the deep history of Tucson, the Tucsonenses, who I just mentioned, who created the original settlement city and the 1960s, quote, urban renewal program that destroyed the Tucsonense neighborhoods, homes, and businesses nicknamed La Calle, including an area of Chinese-owned businesses and homes known as Chinatown. And all this for the purpose of attracting white tourists to the city. As part of this, Tucson elites worked hard to whiten the city's past and erase the Mexican-American, Chinese, and indigenous contributions to the creation of the city, and then to erase their ongoing presence in the area as well. White people created this weird amalgam of Anglo cowboy myth. We're going to talk about how the rodeo is a lie. With fantasy Spanish heritage to whiten the city's past. Raul Romero Villa says this is, quote, the experience of being displaced in multiple ways from a perceived homeland. Anything to add, Ronnie?
Not to the summary, but one thing I do want to touch on is I feel like in a lot of the descriptions for La Calle, it mentions that La Calle looks at the effects of urban renewal. And so, like, I really kind of just want to talk about, like, what is urban renewal? Mm-hmm. And if you Google the definition, the Oxford Dictionary says it's the redevelopment of areas within a large city, typically involving the clearance of slums. That is key language there, people. Mm-hmm. Another definition, urban renewal in geography is the process of redeveloping areas with low property values in order to create new infrastructure and, here it is, increase tax revenue. Mm-hmm. So if a developer wants to tear down cheap housing, kick out poor people, build expensive housing, and bring in the rich folks, city governments are usually happy to help. And that's what we see with zoning committees. It's gentrification. So literally anytime in the reading where you hear urban renewal, hear gentrification, because yeah. It is one of those words like blight mm-hmm. that signals something, that signals that a low-class area, high concentration of poverty.
It's a racialized.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thank you for that, Ronnie. I think that's really important. That's why I said urban renewal in quotes when I was doing my summary, because it's not a real... Like, you shouldn't take it literally. It's not actually, like, invigorating a city or, like, renewing it. It's oftentimes erasing the long history of poor people of color that have established communities that white people don't find valuable. So thanks for that, Ronnie. I mentioned the fact that white settlers kind of created this weird myth of this Anglo past and this, like, Spanish heritage thing being, like, kind of thrown in there. But I wanted to tease out how there was definitely a hierarchy and a preference for making up and showcasing an Anglo identity. And in practice, white Tucsonans showed actually really little regard for preserving the buildings of the Spanish colonial past. Wanted to ask you to give other examples of how did white Tucson elites whiten the history of Tucson?
Well, I think it kind of starts with after World War II, which was driven by the desire to lure tourists. Tucson's image makers organized these cultural events and really carefully crafted a made-up local history that accentuated Anglo and Western past that never happened or never was. The tourist materials that were produced and distributed by the Tucson Chamber of Commerce and the Sunshine Club, which I'll talk about more later, but it was an organization exclusively devoted to promoting tourism. But they really imagined a Tucson that revolved around Anglo cowboys and rodeos and the natives that they were said to have subdued. It was a civic identity grounded in what Otero calls Anglo fantasy heritage.
Yeah, so they kind of decided to claim Sam Hughes, who's a Welsh immigrant, as the founder of Tucson, and created groups like Friends of Fort Lowell to highlight the U.S. Army outposts and the long history of a U.S.-specific Army presence in the area, while neglecting to preserve Mexican-American buildings and histories. One example is they tore down the Sabino Otero House, that had just as much history as the house that they called the Fremont House, the one that was allegedly had ties to John Fremont, except that the only difference was that the Sabino Otero house was owned by a Mexican man. So I say all this to say, because they were only willing to highlight the European parts of Tucson's past and erased all of the Mexican parts, which is really wild considering that there's just an undeniable Mexican influence on the area. City officials took the house down and relocated it, even though that location itself was just as important to the history as the structure itself. And the Fremont House is an example of how they really bent over backwards to try and create this European heritage, because they wanted really badly to tie Tucson to John Fremont, who was the territorial governor. But he actually seemed to have mostly lived his life in Prescott, Arizona. And there was a relative of his who, in historical documents, was listed as living at 245 Main Street. But the truth is that actually no such building existed. And so they relayed what they claimed the contemporaneous map would have looked like and overlaid it onto the modern street structures and then claimed that it was this other building. And the Carrillo family actually lived there and was forcibly relocated so that they could claim that that house was the John Fremont house. And they used wood from the Otero house that the city had demolished to make room for the Fremont house. So it's like literally tearing down Mexican heritage and history and using it to rebuild a false European identity.
Yeah. On one hand, you have like the booster's version of the city's history that's like imposed between the Mexican people who first settled and had lived in Tucson for generations and their heritage. And then on the other hand, their promotion of this vision of a modern Anglo
slash Spanish.
Yeah.
Slash Welsh.
What? It doesn't make any sense.
And it's such an L because the Fremont House didn't even bring in the tourism that the elites had predicted. And the Tucson Pima County Historical Committee actually renamed it the Sosa Carrillo Fremont House in 1991. Just to sort of finally be willing to admit Mexicans live here.
Yeah. Maybe that'll bring the crowds in. Jeez, the people that live in this city.
And this sort of went along with the guilt-relieving narrative of settler colonialism and this argument that Mexicans, similar to indigenous Native Americans, weren't making quote-unquote productive use of the land, and so they deserved it to be stolen from them. And an alternative narrative about, like, a really rich cultural Mexican history that spanned generations wasn't convenient and didn't fit in that narrative. So they demolished it.
So it's got to go.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pueblo Center wasn't as successful as the city planned it to be either. It was eventually demolished, I think in like 2016 around, for more construction. It failed.
Yeah.
And the way they had like painted it, they destroyed these cultural buildings that were of Mexican-American heritage to create buildings and shops that were brightly colored and painted that resembled that cultural authenticity, but was designed to attract boutiques and more high-end. And it failed because it wasn't authentic. And that's what happens when you gentrify the barrio and push out the people that make it home.
Yeah, because you really have to ask, make more attractive for whom?
Mm-hmm.
They were just trying to attract white people. Like, they were trying to get rid of actual Mexican culture and replace it and repackage it with this whitened, clean, safe version for tourists to consume.
Yeah.
The book also talked about the role that television played in emphasizing slash uplifting this Anglo history myth-making, and just wanted to have you talk about how, what role like TV played in driving tourism.
Well, throughout the book, in the first chapter, Otero provides these really cool ads in the second chapter, called Selling Tucson. She shares these really powerful ads that are promoting come to the West, and like there's a photo of natives and it literally says you can still see this in Arizona.
Oh my God.
But the development lobby was composed of local elites that controlled the economy. They were also the strongest planning and zoning advocates.
Surprising.
They were powerful realtors, architects, newspaper editors, bankers, utility company executives that sat on the city's most influential committees. But those of Tucson's elite who benefited from tourism and demographic growth were portrayed by the media, television and newspaper, as being these unselfish negotiators that worked for the betterment of the city and all Tucsonans. And they implemented their visions of modernity, air quotes, whiteness, you know, without any dissent because it was all amongst themselves. But yeah, so I think that the really powerful, these ads that are promoting this Anglo fantasy heritage that show, you know, a cowboy and people dressed in like full cowboy gear. And it's like Tucson promoting Tucson's way of life. And, you know, that was really planted.
I think ads and TV shows and movies that were creating this imaginary Wild Wild West made people in other parts of the country really interested in coming to Tucson to, like, see the real cowboy way of life. And that really helped to create this pioneer narrative where in this, like, the cowboy vision, it always includes Anglos and Indigenous people, and then it erases Spaniards and Mexicans who were here in the Southwest. Local newspapers also played a role in emphasizing slash uplifting this Anglo history myth-making. So wanted to ask if you could go over what some of that was.
The newspapers?
Oh, yes. So, like, there was the Arizona Daily Star, the Tucson Daily Citizen editors-in-chief were involved with the Tucson Heritage Foundation or the Arizona Historical Society, and these were the groups that were trying to push this Anglo past narrative. Which I wanted to emphasize that because there's this idea, like, these are newspapers, by the way, that are still in circulation and that we still read to capture our news. And just want to point out that the editors in chief are not objective people, and, like, they brought agendas. And the Arizona Historical Society was the entity, for example, that voted to decide the final name of the John C. Fremont House. Mm-hmm. You know, they were the ones that made the final call to erase the Carrillo family's history.
Yeah, and then I'm just, like, noticing this quote excerpt from the Tucson Daily Citizen in October 1958, where the headlines say, "As for Tucson's downtown, the paper boasted, 'Look out, it's moving, growing, expanding, and improving.'" And, like, what does that signal? That signals this is good. That signals upward mobility for the city. And then it says, "In appealing to this, promotional articles and advertisements simply ignored established customers and patterns of commerce and said, 'We hope you'll enjoy this new look of your hometown.'" Okay. But we're actually kind of, like, telling you that we're not down with this. But that was, like, actually the problem. I'm sure we'll talk about this in just a sec. But something Otero highlights is that there was a really kind of heinous exclusion of business owners and people that lived in La Calle from being involved in any committees or also voting in whether or not this demolition would happen. Most of the people in the area were renters, tenants. Only 20% owned their homes, including businesses. And then, so in 1966, when the displacement happened, it was a bond election, meaning that only property owners could vote. So most of the residents of La Calle literally didn't have a say in their future. Only 4% of Tucson population voted for, air quotes, urban renewal, gentrification. So, like, 4% of the city, of the elite, of Anglo elite, rich people, made the decision to level such an important hub for the people of color in their city, to destroy it, to displace them.
Yeah. And that excluding of people of color, even those who have been able to obtain some kind of socioeconomic mobility, even business owners were excluded. And that goes back to the first sort of intense Anglo settling of the area. By 1860, Anglos had 87% of the wealth of the city, even though they constituted only 20% of the population. And that kind of power grab was happening cyclically and generationally. That was one of the first instances of it happening. And then this 1960s urban renewal program took away La Calle residents' ability to participate in the decision making of their own, of the future of their own neighborhood, is on that same spectrum of white exploitation of the people of color in the area.
When we talk about the city being like one of the longest inhabited places, mm-hmm. Like we have clay pot shards that have been found at the base of the city's most visible mountain, Sentinel Peak, or a mountain, that have dated Tucson's initial settlement to more than 4,000 years ago, mm-hmm. Adding, you know, the claims that this is the continuously habited place in the U.S. But by the time the Spanish arrived, the Thonaatam had already set up permanent villages complete with irrigation systems. And then, like we talked about, Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and the transfer to U.S. But, like, despite their minority status, Anglo-American settlers immediately asserted their dominance in Tucson, as they do.
And intensely segregated the place,
yeah,
by race.
Right. People of color weren't allowed above Congress. Mm-hmm. Tucson was absolutely segregated, which is why La Calle was such a beautiful, vibrant community.
Yeah, and it was inter-ethnic. You know, it was mm-hmm. Mexican, it was Chinese. And there was a really interesting, like, inter-ethnic mix in the neighborhood that pretty much disappeared by the end of the 1800s. And most of the Tucsonense elite fell into the lower economic classes, and they weren't replaced by other Mexicans because of continuing gentrification. And interestingly enough, gentrification would later lead white people to dominating Barrio Viejo, Tucson's oldest neighborhood, and had the audacity to claim that they made the neighborhood better and improved it from what it once was. So this is, like, it's ongoing.
Yeah, something that I think is really cool that highlights this is just, like, a fun example, is because there was such a melting pot of cultures in La Calle, something that's really unique to Tucson's history and is kind of like a lost historic food is something called Chinese chorizo. And it's really cool. It originated from some of the 100-plus Chinese grocery stores that once existed in, like, around 1950 in South Tucson. And these stores were made possible by the symbiotic relationship between Mexican and Chinese immigrants and naturally became centers for community. They were established at a time when both groups were targeted again for their existence. And these grocery stores supported Tucsonenses in times of hardship, offering food and daily necessities on credit and, like, barter exchange. But so Chinese chorizo models the immigrant story of its origin. It often was made from whatever meat was on hand, end cuts, scraps of meat. And then once it was revived with a mixture of Mexican spices, chilies, a little bit of wine, this meat became transformed into a really sought-after product.
Yeah, there's so much rich culture and history that was lost when La Calle was demolished. Like, one of the areas that Otero highlighted was called Barrio Libre, which white people described it as a place where Mexicans, quote, fled to avoid law enforcement and engaged in, quote, decadence, vice, and corruption. Law enforcement didn't go there. It was a place to avoid the white man's laws and, quote, ways of doing business. And it was called La Calle because it wouldn't make sense to call it El Centro, because most Tucsonense homes were interspersed with their businesses, so there was no, like, downtown where businesses were that was separate from where people lived. It was La Calle because it was a street where people both lived and did business. And, like, which is very, like, Mexico style, by the way. Like, many used a portion of their home for, like, their public-facing business and then lived in another portion of their home. And that was run really contrary to, like, Anglo understandings of separating work and home. And I think it's unfortunate that because people of color's culture and history isn't valued, we don't have that anymore. Now we have, like, the downtown with breweries and, like, and whatever, even, like, some establishments that I do frequent, but I would have rather had like a... In what ways is tourism the most colonial of colonial economies?
I want to just say it's entitlement. Like, it's like, don't even get me started on ecotourism in Central America, in Latin America. Well, particularly Central America.
Costa Rica is definitely a hub of that.
I mean, and Guate and Honduras. Yeah, so much. Puerto Rico. So much of Latin America is like, it's tourism. Okay, but it's entitlement, right? And then specifically thinking in like the ways that Tucson participated in tourism and like who it was trying to bring in. I just think that it's really, it centers white elites. It centers this narrative, that Anglo fantasy narrative that wasn't real and purposefully displaces or it seeks to profit off of the culture that is currently being, like, oppressed. And that's not fair. Why do you get to come and gawk and it's all for the white gaze? But then that makes it safe. That's attracting the right type of person to the city, air quotes. What is that about?
Yeah, I think the white gaze is an important thing to highlight because the dehumanization of the people that are being colonized or invaded is a central part of the colonial project. And I think that seeing people and their culture as something that you're entitled to consume is in line with that same voyeuristic, like, world fair, ogling at people of colors, you know, allegedly different and, like, disformed bodies. And I think
to feed white saviorism.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't. Sometimes. No, because I don't. Well, maybe with ecotourism, yes, they're trying to save that place, but with straight up tourism, it's like you're just there to consume.
Yeah, that's true.
You're there
true.
To like eat the people.
You're there to eat the people. I guess what I was trying to say, or what I was getting at, was like to consume the culture, but then also like to white saviorism. Like in thinking about Barrio Libre, there was so much like a perspective of,
or like Barrio Viejo. You mean where they were like, we made this place better?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, thank you. Thank you for the correction. And it's like, we fixed it for you. You guys can't be trusted to control your own neighborhoods. They're unruly.
Right. Yes.
Disorderly. Yes.
Exactly. No, yeah, because that's the justification for colonialism is, and I think I mentioned this at the top, that like this is a narrative that Anglo settlers had with indigenous people and in this area with Mexicans too, that with the Tucsonense elites, that they were too lazy to make, quote, productive use of the land. And so it was their responsibility. It was their white man's burden to make it productive.
Maybe they just centered rest and pleasure and made time for that in their day, okay? Mm-hmm. White people wouldn't understand.
I mean, they just wanted the land. Making up whatever to steal the land and make it morally justifiable.
Like, chapter 3 is called Selling Tucson, Rewriting History and Then Recasting Its Place. There's a quote by someone named Henry Garcia who grew up in La Calle and was displaced. His quote's from 1987 after the displacement happened. And he said, it, obviously referring to La Calle, would have made a fantastic place. Tourists would have flocked there like flies because they knew it wasn't phony, you know? It was the real thing.
Well, that's the deep irony of this whole thing, is that it was intended to bring in tourism and actually just ended up flattening a culture, displacing a people, and being an economic waste because it didn't generate any tourist dollars for the city itself. I wanted to end with talking about the La Placita Committee and what their goal was and what they accomplished.
Yeah, I think that Lydia Otero talks about how much La Calle was such a vibrant community. It was a commercial heart for not just Mexican Americans, like we highlighted, but people of Chinese descent and Black people, mm-hmm. Where yes. they established what—
I can't mention the Black residents of Tucson tonight. Yeah. Thank you for that.
But Otero called their own spatial reality, where they got to celebrate their culture amongst others who were interested in doing the same. She talks about how during all of these, like, committees and in, like, the regional plans for urban renewal, that there's language, key language, that's talking about using calling them slums, and like really harmful targeting of these communities that wasn't reflective of actually what was there. And so La Placita Committee, they came together. Although those that were displaced by this project weren't able to come together in large numbers to protest, many opposed their removal in ways that remain undocumented. So again, I'm so grateful that Otero was able to capture so many direct quotes from people who lived there. But so La Placita Committee was a group of mostly women who gathered signatures for petitions to say, since they couldn't vote, they did what they could, as we do, they gathered signatures for their petitions to save La Placita, which was the main public square and cultural center. They raised issues and questions about urban renewal. They went to city meetings and development meetings and tried to disrupt. They wrote letters to DC and were just so committed to trying to preserve this area because they knew the cultural significance. As I was about to say, master's tools will not dismantle the master's house. And they weren't successful. But they were able to save a gazebo, which is still there today. And obviously this is important because it represents their resistance and is literally the only remaining portion of La Calle. And I think that that's powerful because it illustrates like how far the city and planning committees, zoning committees were willing to demolish. You know, you had a group of people crying out, please save this cultural hub. Let it continue to be a park. It's so important to us. Do what you will over there. They had already, you know, as communities of colors often do, they don't want to rock the boat and are just don't want to make a fuss and will step back and accept less than what they deserve. And that's not right. But they did that and said, fine, so those are going to go, but please, can we save this? And the city said no. And it literally took, a group of people willing to get in the way. And we still have that. And I think that that's such a huge win despite the total bulldozing they were facing. Saved one gazebo. Yay.
I like you said, it's a testament to resistance. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the La Placita Committee was mostly made up of women because women get shit done. And I appreciate what you're saying about how it's not enough, and it's just sort of like one small representation of what La Calle was. And I think part of what makes this story frustrating for me is that we also, I think this book helped with the, because they had interviews, Lydia like interviewed descendants of La Calle or people who like had early childhood memories of growing up there. And I love that because otherwise we would only have representations of this place from the eyes of white people. And it's such a, you don't fully understand it when you do that, right? Like the one person who described it as a lawless place, right? When it was community. That's where people went to feel free. And she mentions, for example, that Tucsonense business owners refused to list their businesses in white registries. And there's just like, that's just one concrete example of how Tucsonenses, in spite of the oppression that they were facing, also resisted like surveillance and tracking and incorporation into this white capitalist system. They're like, no, we don't want to be a part of it. We don't want to be in your business registry. Our business is not for you.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the committees that spearheaded this displacement was called the Committee on Municipal Blight, comb.
Yeah.
Blight is just a word for something that someone has decided looks ugly or is like a sore to the eye, often to describe people of color, their homes. But so comb, as the acronym goes, they insisted to boosters and other civic leaders that we must have a convention facility so that we can develop a more complete image as a place to visit. We must expand our cultural facilities. We must do something to clean up and clear out the unsightly near downtown slum areas. And the city, with the cooperation of the county and state and federal officials, moved to do just that. And I think that this is a testament to the displacement that we still see people who have lived in Tucson forever still facing today with the enforcement of sweeps, of encampments of unsheltered neighbors, the viewing of unsheltered neighbors as, like, vagrants, as, like, outsiders, when truly they are just Tucsonenses who have already been displaced and can't afford to regain their footing. And obviously that's going, we're going to just see those effects further compounded the more housing costs rise and the further away we are from rent control and, like, actually the dissolution of rent and landlordism, but that's another convo. But yeah, we see displacement happening in this way to create the complete image, this image without blight. We want to clean up the city center for the gem show. We want to put rocks. We want to pay to put rocks under freeway passes because we don't want
to stop people from sleeping under them.
To stop people from sleeping and begging for money by all of those, like, carbon emissions. Like, it's not a great or safe place for people to already exist. Why, instead of making it more unhospitable, wouldn't
make
you
make it more hospitable?
Exactly. Or make the city more hospitable. Stop pushing less desired people into the dark corners of our city and instead embrace our neighbors and celebrate what they have to offer to this very unique place that we all call home.
Yeah, I think that's really important to point out because this is a book, this is a historical text, but this fight is not over and it's happening actually in real time because this language of urban renewal, of blight, of slums and cleaning them is literally what the city is using right now to incarcerate and criminalize our unhoused neighbors. And so there's not a, you know, deeply concentrated neighborhood of rich cultural diversity in this way that they had in La Calle, but we do have communities of folks who are trying to survive and make community wherever they can, and the city won't even accept that. And instead of addressing the systemic neglect the city has engaged in that's resulted in people being unhoused, they just make it harder for unhoused people to live. And it's about displacement in the way that the zoning people, the urban developers didn't want to see poor people of color in La Calle. Now these city leaders don't want to see poor, unhoused people of color in their various parks, in the
downtown area,
in Tucson.
There it is.
Well, Ronnie, thank you so much for joining me. I'm trying to think of what to close with. And I think what I'm going to end with is asking you how Tucson residents can get involved in mutual aid work that is working to mitigate the housing crisis.
Yeah, there's so many different ways, and it can look like whatever you have capacity for. It can look like offering or remembering to keep cold water bottles in your car. And as you're driving around the city doing your errands, just having those available to pass out to people that you see, taking the time to literally pull over and be like, hey, neighbors, anyone want water? And as you feel safe, approaching, people will always be grateful. No one's going to be like, no, I want money. They're like, oh, my gosh, thank you so much every time. We live in Tucson. We live in Arizona. Mm-hmm. I think, like, bear solidarity. We can just like offer people shade, respite, water, and make sure they have something to regulate their body temperature. I know I feel hot just walking to my car, waiting for my car to cool down. And I have to like pause to remember that some people don't have a place to go cool off their body temperature. And that's really shitty. Other ways is getting involved with groups like Community on Wheels, After School Anarchy, Community Cares Tucson, starting your own in your neighborhood. Unsheltered people live in your neighborhood. Get to know them. Ask their name. Say, hey, neighbor, how you doing? Look them in the eyes when you talk to them. Other ways can be join the Tenants Union, Tucson Tenants Union. If you're listening in L.A., join the L.A. Tenants Union. If you're listening in Phoenix, join Valley Tenants Union. Join your local tenants union. You do not have to be a tenant to join, but you can still support. And in the way that labor unions uplift workers and protect with anonymity, ooh, that's a tricky word, and protect against retaliation from landlords and corporate landlords, and which are essentially businesses, it's people power, and it's the only thing, the only hope we have at this moment. I'm so grateful for electeds like Annalise Ortiz and Ana Hernandez, shout out, who have been working to advance housing policy in whatever ways.
Is Ana Hernandez a Zionist?
No way, homie. Ana Hernandez is a very proud abolitionist. I would love to introduce you. Okay, no, great. She's a homie. She
Do you know
totally
who I'm talking
stands.
About, though? The Arizona Democrat?
Maybe Lydia Hernandez.
Okay,
she's
I
also.
Apologize. It's the Hernandez.
I know. Sorry, we're not all a conglomerate. It's my mom's maternal name, whatever. No, Ana Hernandez.
Okay,
write that down.
Abolitionist.
She's the homie.
Good.
And she is writing for Palestine. It's free Palestine until it's backwards. Yeah, they have just been struck down with moving any legislature through Congress because there's a lot of landlords that are currently in our state legislature, and we have – Arizona is not interested. We brag about being low state taxes and low property taxes because we want to attract – not we, but the state wants to attract – that commerce still and is pricing people out from living there. And so I really think that what we need is to just join our tenants union and really get involved in the conversation around rent control and maybe even thinking about insisting to city council that they create more forms of social housing, more forms of community-controlled housing, and return those funds to the city, to the people who live and make these cities so great in the resources that they need, which are housing. Tucson wants to brag about its Housing First program. Fund it. Mm-hmm. Put more money towards it. It's incredibly impacted. There's no housing. The beds are full. I'm tired of hearing Regina talk about, we're centering housing. Our resources go out and offer people resources, and y'all can't even take the time to move at the speed of trust and get to know people, establish relationships. Just coming on in. Nope, everyone refused services. And then what do? We come in and arrest them next. And
okay,
it's
so
heinous.
Alma Hernandez is a Zionist.
Okay.
And she literally has it in her social media bio.
Okay.
But
okay,
so Anna Hernandez is an Arizona senator who was born in Phoenix, born and raised
yes,
in Phoenix.
Yes, Maribel.
And is a first-generation daughter of Mexican-born parents,
mm-hmm.
who is cool, you're saying.
So badass.
Just wanted to put that out there because I would guess if I made that confusion, if I like got confused by that, someone else
might be. Important distinctions.
Important.
We got to know who our people are.
Who you can trust.
Yeah.
You can't. Okay, well, Ronnie, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You're a treasured cachimbona. Mm. And you'll be back soon because we're going to talk about Prisca Lorca-Mojica's Rodriguez's book. Días en primas.
We have so much reading to do. I love it.
Yay.
Thanks for being my reading buddy.
Bye, cachimbonas.
Do and
encourage people who want to support the podcast to become a Patreon subscriber for as little as $3 a month. You will get access to a bunch of episodes like these. If you enjoyed this episode, I highly recommend that you become a patron and get into the back catalog of all the past seasons of The Lit Review. And just to really hit home the point about supporting the podcast through Patreon, this is an independently run podcast with no ads. That's something intentional to keep the integrity of the podcast. By supporting and joining through Patreon, you allow this to be a sustainable practice for me. I've been doing this since 2017 and have always been powered by the Patreon and the patrons who are members of the community. So head to the link in the show note to become a patron. If you are unable to support monetarily, you can also support in a 100% free way by leaving an Apple Podcast or Spotify Podcast rating and review. Share why you love listening to the podcast. You can also follow at Radio Cachimbona on X, Facebook, and Instagram. Thanks so much for being here, Cachimbonas. Love y'all.